It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll hear about the Older Americans Act. It turns 50 years old today, but faces an uncertain future in the coming years.
First, international leaders reached a historic deal to rein in Iran's nuclear program this morning after 2 years of negotiating. Today, representatives of Iran, the U.S., and other countries involved held a final meeting in Vienna. Many Republicans in Congress oppose the deal, and Israeli leadership has spoken out against it. Congress has 60 days to review the agreement.
Joe Greco is with us now to go over the details of that deal. He's a professor of political science at Duke University. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be with you this afternoon on this important day.
Well, let's start with the details of this deal announced this morning. How much would it really curtail Iran's potential to get nuclear weapons?
I think I have not read the full text, so I'm working off the summaries that have become available on a variety of news websites. The agreement closely follows the framework that was established back in April. My own view is that it produces a restriction on Iran's ability to acquire nuclear weapons for at least 10 years, perhaps. And when I say significantly, I mean reducing or increasing the amount of time required by Iran were to try to make a dash for nuclear weapons from at present, which is maybe 3 months, to maybe 12 months. If Iran wants nuclear weapons, it can build nuclear weapons. What this agreement does is makes it harder for Iran to get them without the United States and its allies discovering that breakout effort. So in that sense, that is the, for at least 10 years, I think there would be this increase in the period in which such an effort would be detected. Beyond 10 years, the period would be less, going down to a very brief period of time. But essentially, it does put off a breakout capacity for about 10 years.
Now, the old Reagan line, I think, was trust but verify when it came to nuclear negotiations. President Obama said this deal is not about trust. It's about verification. From what we know of this extensive deal, what kind of verification efforts would be in place?
Yes, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, would have, under this agreement, enhanced ability to inspect any site in Iran, whether that had been there had been some pushback from Iran's top leaders after the April framework agreement that military sites would be off limits. This agreement, as I understand it, does not discriminate across different types of sites that would be open to IAEA inspection. All sites would be inspected. There is a process by which they would be notified. And if Iran were to resist, then there would be quite soon thereafter that resistance, there would be reintroduction of economic sanctions. So on the verification procedures, it's at least as strong as the April agreement. It's stronger than the current ability of the international community to investigate Iranian nuclear activities.
So that's what we get, the West, the countries negotiating with Iran here. Iran has been looking for an end to the major sanctions. A lot of Iranian money is frozen, assets frozen in other countries. If they abide by the agreement, do they get all that back?
In a period of time, it is not an immediate lifting of sanctions. I tried to check on that. And as I understand some statements from Secretary Kerry, there will be a phased lifting of the sanctions. And yes, over a period of time, as the verification determines, if the verification process determines that Iran is living up to its side of the bargain, there would be access by Iran to roughly $100 billion in frozen, basically cash, now being held in a variety of banking accounts to which they do not have access. Number two, they would probably be able to increase oil exports from the current level, which is about 1.1 million barrels a day, It's possible, depending upon market conditions, they could get up to the 2 million, maybe even 2.5 million barrels a day, and they would have immediate access to the foreign exchange earnings from that sale. Today, they don't get immediate access to all of the hard currency they earn. So they would be able to, and that's what's in it for them, is they get the foreign exchange earnings of 2 to 2.5 million barrels per day plus the 100 billion that's frozen.
Talking to Joe Greco from Duke University, looking at this morning's announcement of a nuclear deal with Iran. Well, let's get to some of the reaction to this, Joe. Republicans in Congress, many of them not happy, including many from our own delegation. Presidential candidates on the Republican side, Governor Scott Walker said in his kickoff speech yesterday, day one, he cancels a deal if it's reached. What are the objections from Republicans on Congress and in the presidential race?
I think the central concern that is being expressed in the press and in the media is that twofold. First, even within the 10 years, Iran will have access to more financial resources, and the fear that they'll turn those financial resources not for the betterment of the Iranian people, but to support terrorism and other anti-U.S. Interests, for example, Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is an arch enemy of Israel. The second concern is that in the middle term, let's see, years 11 through 15, the restrictions on Iranian R&D on nuclear activities would be such that that one-year breakout period would shrink quite significantly down to basically a few months. So I think those are the two main objections. The third point that's often made by the opposition is that the sanctions have proven to be very effective, and they're correct about that, and continuing or even accentuating them might produce either a better deal or even better than that, a collapse of the Iranian regime and its replacement by a regime that would not seek nuclear weapons and would be friendly to the United States and Israel. So I think those are the two specific points in the general, and the third idea is a more general idea.
And Israeli leadership, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, are raising similar objections, a direct threat to Israel. Another player in that area, though, Saudi Arabia, concerned about this deal, has been all along. What is their worry about this nuclear agreement?
I think they have two concerns. The immediate concern is that they will be facing a stronger Iranian adversary, and this rivalry has been in effect for decades, and the Saudis may feel that this represents an opportunity for Iran to be a more formidable foe. Number two, they, in their worst nightmare, they may be concerned that a U.S. rapprochement with Iran is around the corner, a realignment by the United States away from Saudi Arabia, tilting toward Iran might occur in the next, that this represents that, the beginning of that process, and that Saudi Arabia would be left on its own. I think that second point is clearly, I doubt that's, well, that's their concern. I'm not sure how realistic a concern it is.
Is it possible that this could open the door to some more forms of cooperation against groups like ISIS? There is some cooperation there already going on in Iraq. Could there be more cooperation like that in the future after this deal?
I would not place too much hope in that expectation. I would say that the hardliners in Iran are going to resist and try to freeze. I mean, there's some tacit cooperation, but I don't think we're going to see this agreement spilling over into additional issue areas anytime soon. I think each side is going to need a period of time, I'm afraid measured in years, to develop confidence in the other, perhaps through the successful implementation of the agreement for both sides. So I don't see significant cooperation beyond this agreement anytime soon.
Joe, thanks a lot for being with us again.
Thank you, Rob. It was my pleasure.
That's Joe Greco, professor of political science at Duke University, with us to talk about the historic nuclear deal announced with Iran this morning.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Older Americans Act being signed into law. The legislation put into place a wide range of social services and programs for individuals 60 years and older, with the goal of helping Americans age at home.
But 50 years later, the act faces an uncertain future. Congress hasn't reauthorized it since 2006, so when they extended support into 2011. Now, as the elderly population in the U.S. continues to grow, is the act meeting the needs of the people who need it most?
Here with us now to take a closer look at the Older Americans Act is Jeanette Arms. She's the interim director of the Milwaukee County Department on Aging. Jeanette, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So today is the 50th anniversary of the Older Americans Act being signed into law. Can you give us a more complete picture of what exactly this act does?
Well, this act actually, first of all, it was put in place because of the lack of community and social services for seniors. And now the act helps to mandate that each state develop a coordinated and comprehensive plan to provide services, programs, opportunities, and protections for seniors. Through this act, seniors can enjoy the full measure of life, and it allows seniors to live in their homes and communities for as long as they like with a variety of diverse programs that fits the needs and desires of seniors.
So is this something that would encompass things like hot meals, assistance with bathing, and social opportunities, things like that?
Sure. Some of the services that are provided through the Older Americans Act are the home-delivered and congregate meals, family care service support, home and community-based services, prevention health programs, also job training, adult protective services and elder abuse, and we also provide foster grandparent programming.
Can you give us a sense about why this act was first created?
Well, the act, again, was created because of the lack of community and social services for seniors, and the need truly existed. Older adults needed to have opportunities to thrive in their communities and opportunities to be socially engaged, to be active, to have services that fit their needs so that, again, they could thrive and live long, active, and hopefully healthy lives.
How many people use the Older Americans Act and the benefits you're talking about?
Well, in the United States, I think that there are over 3 million people that actually use the services throughout the U.S. Now, in Wisconsin, I don't have a comprehensive number, but I can say that we have 3.7 million meals served or had those 3.7 million meals served in 2014, and 65,000 unduplicated individuals received meals. Family caregiver support, which helps educate individuals, provides respite support and other helpful resources. 2,500 families were served. Also, through home and community-based services in Wisconsin, which are services that include information and assistance, legal services, and home care services, and many other types of services. We had 97,000 contacts related to counseling, which helped people understand the complexities of signing up for the State Health Insurance Program, or SHIP. We had 35,000 outreach events for educating people and creating awareness of the SHIP program. 30,000 people received elder benefit or legal services, which was a savings impact of $115 million, which is very impactful. We actually had 230 older adults in Wisconsin receive training for employment. We had 6,000 alleged cases of abuse and exploitation as it relates to adult protective services and elder abuse.
And stepping back to get a bigger picture, when people use the Older Americans Act and the benefits there, what changes for them when they may be able to age at home or a place of their choosing instead of, say, being sent to a nursing home or some sort of other institution? How does that affect the economy and affect the people individually?
Well, again, people do better when they're able to live at home in their communities among people who care for them. People are able to be engaged, continue to be engaged with their friends, build new friendships as they age. They can also contribute to the community through volunteerism, through working, bringing back their veteran skills and knowledge into the economy. In addition to the fact that in Wisconsin, we have 780,000 older adults who are 60 years plus, and that number is going to grow. When we have these types of services available, it really is impactful to the economy, because those people are using Older American Act services, which keep people out of nursing homes, which is far more costly than having them live within the community.
We're talking right now with Jeanette Arms, Interim Director of the Milwaukee County Department on Aging, talking about the Older Americans Act signed into law 50 years ago. And let's talk about how that law is faring today. Now, Congress last reauthorized the act in 2006, and it hasn't been fully funded since then. That 2006 authorization lasted through 2011. So how has that lack of reauthorization played out in the services people get over the last few years?
Well, funding in 2014 for the Older Americans Act was $1.8 billion. And it's been pretty flat over the past decade. So it's not keeping up with the demand for services as required by the rapidly aging population. And the Older American Act, as I mentioned previously, it certainly provides significant savings when we're keeping people at home opposed to people going to nursing homes. On average, at the national level, 85% of people who receive Older American Act support, they say that the services provided allow them to remain at home or in the community and out of nursing homes. So again, it's very costly to society, to the economy, when Older American Act dollars don't keep up with the demand for the older population.
And you said the population of aging is growing, it's getting bigger. What do you see happening if some of these services may not be funded fully?
Well, people won't thrive. We'll probably have more cases of abuse and neglect, older people being taken advantage of, us not being aware of those issues, in addition to the fact that more older adults will end up in nursing homes. They'll end up in skilled nursing facilities, which will be impactful to the economy and to society, and it will be tasking on our taxpayers.
Now, we've got two other big government programs turning 50 this year, too, Medicare and Medicaid. How do you see the Older Americans Act as fitting into that big picture? Do you think that it's maybe being seen as redundant?
Oh, no. Well, Medicare and Medicaid, of course, were signed into law by President Johnson in 1965, and these are health insurance programs that support the poor and elderly and provide nursing home care for older adults and people with disabilities. So along with the Older Americans Act, these are very strong programs that support the needs of seniors. However, whereas you have to meet certain employment or income an asset-based criteria to qualify for Medicare and Medicaid. And with the Older American Act programs, these are no-cost services, and there are no eligibility requirements. It's open to all individuals 60 years and older, regardless of social or economic status.
Jeanette, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jeanette Arms, Interim Director of the Milwaukee County Department on Aging. She joined us to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Older Americans Act being signed into law.
Coming up after the news, we'll get two perspectives on the economic comparison between Wisconsin and Minnesota. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. When President Barack Obama visited La Crosse earlier this month, he drew comparisons between the economies of Wisconsin and Minnesota. He said Wisconsin put trickle-down economics into practice and Minnesota put middle-class economics into practice. And he went on to cite Minnesota's lower unemployment rate and higher median income, saying Minnesota is winning the border war.
Our next guest disagrees. He wrote a recent op-ed titled Wisconsin's Business Climate Outshines Minnesota. He's with us today to lay out that argument. Kurt Bauer is the president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, great to be on.
Now, what did you think when you first heard President Obama's assertion that Minnesota's economy is stronger than Wisconsin's because he said of different policies?
We've heard that before. It's been a common talking point since Governor Walker took over, and then, of course, you've had Governor Mark Dayton. The two could not be more polar opposites in their approach to economic policies, and so the comparison is obvious. The concern I had was that I don't think it was put in proper context from the standpoint that, frankly, I do think that Minnesota is winning the border battle, but they have been for a long time, and there are a variety of systemic reasons for that. But what I wanted to point out that I do think that Wisconsin is taking the necessary steps to repair our business climate so that we are more competitive going forward. Minnesota's taken an opposite tack, but I think it's going to be, 10 years or so for this case study to really play itself out, and we'll have to see what Wisconsin and what Minnesota looks like after that time period.
Yeah, through various elections, Kurt, we've been watching monthly or quarterly jobs reports to see if there are upticks, looking at job creation rates. Both sides, pro or con, on Governor Walker, pulling out the numbers that are right for them. You say the numbers that are happening now aren't really telling the whole story. So what kind of things are you saying are building a success in the future?
Well, since 2013, Wisconsin has improved in every major economic ranking or report card, which shows that we're making progress. Now, that doesn't mean that we're surpassing Minnesota or even other states in the upper Midwest. You look at all of the different types of metrics that people look at, income, and Wisconsin's actually outpacing Minnesota right now in income growth, but that maybe isn't as great as it sounds from the standpoint that Minnesota has higher income than we do, and we really have no place to go but up. You look at job growth. Well, we didn't get hit as hard during the economic downturn of the Great Recession, so we didn't have as far of a hole to climb out of. All of these things have to be put in proper context. And what we can do is try and control what destiny we can. Wisconsin is only 2% of the national economy. I don't know what that translates into the global economy. But the reality is that we're somewhat of a windsock economy. We don't control our own destiny. But what we can control are some of the policies that attract business investment here, which will grow jobs ultimately and lead to a better quality of life for Wisconsinites.
And what kind of things would you point to over the last 4 years or so in terms of state economic policy that would help us do that?
We always talk about at WMC as the holy trinity of taxes, regulation, and litigation. We're trying to reduce the cost of doing business in the state and make it easier to do business in the state from a permitting standpoint. And we have reduced taxes in the state. We need to do more. We would like to see Wisconsin get out of the infamous top 10. We're still a high-tax state. That's a problem for us. And it does matter. You do see businesses and investment go where there is lower taxes. Particularly, you see the brain drain, and this relates to how we have scored recently on entrepreneurship. The Kauffman Institute or the foundation recently said we are 50th in entrepreneurship. Well, one of the reasons I think you can blame on that is the fact that our tax rate encourages people when they retire to take their wealth to a low tax jurisdiction like Arizona or Florida, which ultimately handicaps us for startups and venture capital.
A counter argument is often that, yes, taxes and regulations are part of what businesses are looking for. They're also looking for places with a good quality of life where they can find educated employees who want to live there. So is it worth maybe keeping some of the taxes up to pay for those quality of life worker training types of services?
Absolutely. And I think at the state level, the two most important things you can invest in are infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, particularly important in Wisconsin because our three largest business sectors, manufacturing, agriculture, and tourism, all rely on good roads and infrastructure, and then, of course, education. So you do have to make those types of investments, but we have. We've got a world-class university system. We've probably got the best tech college system in the world. We've got, by and large, good K-12. We've got some pockets where we need reform and we need to see better results. But by and large, we have those things. So does Minnesota. So you have to look at systemically, why is Minnesota outperforming us? And the research that I've done on this, probably the biggest reason is that they've got a concentration of population within the Twin Cities area, whereas Wisconsin's population is more dispersed. One of the things that does for them is it allows for greater job mobility and more competition for job, which really does crank up incomes in Minnesota as compared to Wisconsin.
Talking to Kurt Bauer, President and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, about the comparison that President Obama, a lot of other people have been making between the economies of Wisconsin and Minnesota. So let's talk about the university system a little more as an economic driver. You mentioned that's something we've got here in the state. So does Minnesota. UW system taking some significant budget cuts again in the newest budget. Is that a concern for you that we may be cutting the budget to something that's key to our economic future?
I think we do have to watch it. The University of Wisconsin system, and I'm a product of it, a UW-Madison grad, so you know I have some allegiance here, but I think we have to watch the cuts there, but we also have to take a look at it in its totality. We have a very expensive secondary education delivery system in Wisconsin. We've got 13 four-year campuses, we've got 13 two-year campuses, then we've got 16 technical colleges with 49 locations. That's 75 locations. At some point, we're probably going to have to look at, as we look at the demographics, can taxpayers afford to maintain all of those campuses? And frankly, is there going to be enrollment demand for that many campuses?
You mentioned the Twin Cities as a concentrated economic area. And in your piece, you contrast that with Milwaukee. Also, you say the Twin Cities are, in many ways, the only game in town in their region. Milwaukee sandwiched between Chicago and the Twin Cities. Do you see ways to harness the power of our biggest urban region of the state?
I think Milwaukee is a great asset for the state. I think it could be more so. Yeah, I was just at Summerfest with my wife and enjoying walking along the Third Ward. You know, Minnesota, the Twin Cities has a river. Milwaukee's got a river. It also has a great lake and one of the most beautiful lakefronts. I think the answer is absolutely, but I think we need a plan to harness the power of Milwaukee and to attract people. I frankly think that, you know, they have their Twin Cities, we have ours. Madison and Milwaukee are important urban centers for Wisconsin. That's particularly important because the data shows millennials really want urban living. And we've got to make sure that Milwaukee and Madison can compete to attract young urban professionals.
Now, let's go to the other side of the border for a moment. You said current stats, Minnesota looking pretty good, but some of the things you see changing there you think are going to be bad for the future of business there. What kind of changes do you see there?
Well, Governor Dayton is raising taxes. He's raising the cost of doing business on regulation, adding more and more obstacles to doing business in that state. They increased the minimum wage, which shows that it costs people jobs. It is not pro-competitive. It is not viewed by the business community as something they see as attractive. So I think they're really heading in the opposite direction. And in fact, recently, the CNBC study came out, and Minnesota ranked higher than Wisconsin. Wisconsin moved up in that ranking, but Minnesota was still higher. And I got an email from my friends at the Minnesota Chamber, you know, wondering why that is, because they see a problem up there, whereas here in Wisconsin, we've got 90% of our business members believe that Wisconsin's heading in the right direction. That's not the case in Minnesota. And business optimism does matter. Optimistic businesses hire, pessimistic ones don't.
Now, you've said it's too early to measure the success of Governor Walker's reforms when it comes to business. When do you think we'll start to see some of these reforms paying off in job growth, income growth, other measures?
Well, like I said, I think that we're really dependent on the national and the global economies. I think we're going to have to see a sustained growth in those two economies before Wisconsin really begins to churn. I just don't think that at 2% of the national economy that we can really do it on our own. I think you're going to have to realistically, though, look at this 5 to 10 years out to see what kind of changes, what kind of impacts there were from Governor Walker's reforms versus Governor Dayton's reforms. I think it takes that long.
Kurt, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Kurt Bauer. He's president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, with us to talk about why he says Wisconsin's long-term business climate is looking better than Minnesota's.
We just heard from Kurt Bauer of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about how he says Wisconsin's business climate outshines Minnesota's. He wrote his opinion piece in response to remarks by President Obama that Minnesota was doing better economically than Wisconsin because of middle-class economics. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jennifer Epps Addison joins us now for another perspective. She's the executive director at Wisconsin Jobs Now. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was your reaction to President Obama making the case that our neighbors in Minnesota are better off because of their different approach to economic policy?
Look, I think the president was responding to a number of sources that have also cited the fact that Minnesota's economy seems to be far outpacing Wisconsin's. And while Mr. Bauer's piece was interesting, you know, it was an opinion piece, it wasn't based on a lot of fact. In fact, he didn't really have a single citation from a credible source to back up the claim that Wisconsin is outshining Minnesota. There is one clear piece from Forbes magazine. In November of 2014, Forbes magazine listed Minnesota as the 9th best state in the nation for business, citing quality of life, better education, and a healthy population as a few of the reasons. On the other hand, Governor Walker's Wisconsin was ranked number 32.
The idea, the case Kurt Bauer was making is that long run, higher taxes going up in Minnesota, taxes going down in Wisconsin, regulations, similar trends. Long term, that's going to bring more business to Wisconsin, less to Minnesota. You don't buy that?
I don't buy it at all. Look, you know, you have the example of the South, right? And they have incredibly low taxes in the South, and that is not the primary reason why businesses choose to locate there, particularly the type of growth industries we're looking at. You know, our governor is claiming that we need a more educated workforce in order to attract businesses and to restart our economy, and yet our governor has had the largest cuts, the second highest cuts in public education in the country, and the largest cuts we've seen in Wisconsin. You know, by comparison, Minnesota invested in education. They raised taxes and they reinvested that money into education. They increased the minimum wage so that workers are earning enough to support their families, and those workers then turn around and spend in their local economies. I think we have to understand that a $1.6 billion cut to public education in governor's first term, coupled with the $250 million cut to the UW system, are exactly the types of decisions and priorities that are seriously hindering our state's ability to come out of and emerge out of the Great Recession.
Now, Minnesota has generally fared better than Wisconsin economically for a while now. Do you think it's fair to put the blame or the credit on the policies of the respective governors there?
Well, I think that it's fair to put I think it's about budget priorities, and I think that, you know, our economic decisions and our budget decisions have economic consequences. So you look, for instance, at Minnesota investing in education, and we know that for, you know, you see an incredible return on investments in education, not just in having a more highly educated workforce, but also in terms of the economic stimulus of investing in education. You look at Minnesota and their decision to take Medicaid expansion. expansion funds, which Governor Walker refuses to do. And even as we had to cut hundreds of millions of dollars from our prized university system, the Republicans in the state legislature have refused to do. And then you see that, you know, you hear the statistics that Minnesota has now has the lowest premiums in the entire country because they've taken this money and they've prioritized in making sure that every one of their citizens has access to affordable coverage. Valuing the health of your citizens is an economy-boosting policy, one that we are not taking on here in the state of Wisconsin that we should be. And in fact, that the majority of the state believes that we should be doing. So you have to look at what's really driving this. And the reality is that in Mr. Bauer's opinion and in Governor Walker's administration, corporations and what's best for the profits of corporations are what's driving their economic decisions. And what we're saying, what we say at Wisconsin Jobs Now, what our hundreds of members across the state are saying is that we think that what is in the best interest of the everyday person, the person who gets up and works hard, the person who is working two or three jobs, the person who doesn't know how they're going to cover their light bill and their rent this month, we think that investing and focusing our economic decision-making on what's in the best interest of those folks, how do we expand opportunity to those folks, how do we get a greater share of our population into the middle class, that is what is going to drive a healthy economy for Wisconsin, and that those are the priorities that our governor and that our business community should be focusing on.
Talking to Jennifer Epps Addison. She's executive director at Wisconsin Jobs Now. Looking at Wisconsin's economy, in part in comparison with Minnesota's, a lot of people have made that comparison, including President Obama when he was visiting La Crosse earlier this month. Jennifer, an issue you and Wisconsin Jobs Now have worked on a lot is the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Make the case that minimum wage increases would do what you said, bring more people into the middle class.
I mean, absolutely. Look, 70% of the country's economy is consumer spending. So we already know that if folks are making too little to be able to actually go out and spend in the economy, then our economy is going to stall. When you look at a state like Wisconsin, we actually had the largest decline in middle-class income in the entire country. And we're feeling that in terms of the growth of our economy. If we want to get our economy moving more rapidly, then we need to put more money in the pockets of folks who are going to go out and spend that money every day. But I think we need to be clear that this is not some unearned benefit. This is not charity to workers. That, you know, CEO pay and the massive corporations like Walmart and McDonald's are skirting their responsibility to the citizens of our state. We invest heavily in both creating the infrastructure and in providing the workforce so that they can make their profits. And then we turn around and subsidize them through public assistance programs and subsidize their poverty wages. And so Wisconsin Jobs Now has been focused on two things. It's been focused on bringing that reality out of the shadows, but it's been focused on telling the corporations that are operating within our state that they need to pay their fair share, that they cannot claim that they can't afford to pay workers fairly, to pay them enough to actually live on without being on public assistance, and then give CEOs compensation in the rate of 100, or in the case of fast food, 1,000 times more than the average worker. That is bad for the state, it's bad for our communities, and it weakens our overall economic output.
The argument against that, and we heard that from Kurt Bauer just a little while ago, is that you're in effect increasing labor costs for businesses that have a choice of where to locate. If they get to pay $3 or $5 or $8, depending on the amount, an hour less, why wouldn't they go somewhere else instead of the place that raised its minimum wage?
Well, look, I mean, we've heard this from business community over and over again. It's the sky is falling mentality, but the reality doesn't match it. And the truth is that the places in our country where the economy is growing the fastest, where there's been a rapid increase in economic opportunity, are the same communities in the same states that have actually increased their minimum wage. So I think, you know, what we need to be asking ourselves are, what type of communities are we trying to build, and what does every single Wisconsin citizen deserve, and what should the government's role be in ensuring and maintaining that system? So I would argue, for instance, that rather than subsidizing the profits of corporations, it is the responsibility of our state government to hold those corporations accountable and to ensure that if they're going to operate in our state, that workers are paid enough to live free from the necessity of public assistance, that workers take home enough to meet the basic costs of living, like providing a roof over their heads, taking care of their children, and having a dignified life. justice. That is the promise, actually, that our forefathers in the progressive movement committed to our state when they passed the state's living wage law, when they introduced and passed that living wage law that Governor Walker just essentially removed from his budget. You know, we had a commitment at one point. We had a law on the books for 104 years that said that every single worker in the state shall be paid a living wage, and that wage should be and must be enough for them to live in reasonable comfort and decency. Governor Walker erased that law in his budget in the budget that he just signed, and that is the wrong way forward for our state, and it's going to lead to a continued decline in economic opportunity for our citizens.
And Jennifer, briefly as we wrap up, apart from minimum wage increases, what would be one more thing that would make Wisconsin's economy stronger, better for the middle class?
Absolutely. We need to deal with scheduling, and we need to deal with the new Wisconsin economy. The reality is that too many people are working part-time jobs and do not have access to full-time work. Governor Walker just made this worse when he signed now in the budget, taking away a guaranteed weekend and forced a seven-day work week on a number of people in our state. So we need to address scheduling. We need fair practices that enable people to make reasonable accommodations for another job, for child care, for illness. That is how we make a stronger workforce, a workforce that's more reliable, and a workforce at the end of the day that's going to be better for boosting business.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jennifer Epps Addison, Executive Director at Wisconsin Jobs Now, with us to talk about the economic comparisons between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Kurt Bauer from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce also joined us. One of the world's most successful rappers is in the international news this week and may show up later this month in a grocery store liquor section near you.
The rapper 50 Cent has sold more than 30 million albums worldwide and has been cited for his business skills too, with investments in a number of industries. But this week, he filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after rulings against him in two lawsuits, each costing him millions of dollars.
So that's out there. But then we see in the news today that 50 Cent will be appearing at grocery stores in Wisconsin later this month, the Woodman's in Oak Creek and in Sun Prairie. He's going to be there to promote his line of vodka.
That's right. The Woodman's in Sun Prairie.
Right.
You heard us right. He'll be signing bottles of vodka. That's it. That's pretty much all he's
doing. Contract, I guess, is that's all he does. Now, when I think of the live and large hip hop lifestyle, suburban grocery store liquor section isn't the first thing that leaps to my mind.
And Rob, you had fun earlier. You were scrolling down the Facebook page at Woodman's and seeing all kinds of,
muffins,
Cliff Bars,
Fitty.
Mosquito repellent, and then
Fitty coming coming to Wisconsin.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Let us know if you're going to queue up to see him and get a signed bottle of vodka from 50 Cent at a grocery store near you.